Hi, Josh.
Hi there, Brink. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. For our audience, I'm Brink Lindsey from the Cato Institute.
Josh Cohen from Stanford and Boston Review.
We thought we'd start off today reminiscing a little bit about a special libertarian moment that occurred last month when the Cato Institute held its biennial Milton Friedman Prize for Advancing Liberty dinner, feting this year's winner, Iranian journalist and dissident Akbar Ganji. Yeah. And all the guests to the dinner received a little book, which I'll hold up here, called The Road to Democracy in Iran by Akbar Ganji. With a foreword by none other than Joshua Cohen, and published by Boston Review, MIT Press. Here we came together, the Cato Institute and Josh Cohen have a common interest in Akbar Ganji. Why don't you start off in telling me how you got involved with him?
Yes, I was very pleased that the collaboration. We made a market together for
yes.
the book. The foreword is by me and my friend and colleague at Stanford, Abbas Milani,
right.
Who's Iranian and knows Ganji well. So the story on Ganji is he's about 50, 51, mm-hmm. Was a supporter of the Iranian Revolution in 1979. In fact, a member of the Revolutionary Guard,
right.
in I think 79 to about 82,
fought in the Iraq War.
Fought in the Iran-Iraq War. Became concerned about the war in the early 80s and was one of the co-authors of a, I think to this day, unpublished letter to Khomeini. Saying that this was not a good proposition for Iran and resigned from the Revolutionary Guard, but remained a supporter of the revolution. He was then stationed in Turkey, I think as a cultural attaché.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Affiliated with the Iranian embassy there. And I think interestingly was involved in those years with Turkish Muslims who have become part of the kind of Turkish Islamic democracy. He eventually really broke from the regime and became a journalist and wrote two books, one on criticizing the corruption of the Rafsanjanis, and the other was a book on the killings of a bunch of Iranian intellectuals. I think five
right.
were killed, but it was part of a larger plot against the intellectuals
the squelch dissent,
in Iran.
Right.
And as a consequence of that work as a journalist, was sent to prison. He spent 6 years in prison and was eventually released after he spent 70 some odd days on a hunger strike.
Yep.
And it was probably in many ways a unique moment when he was released, because pressure for his release came from a very broad coalition, including George Bush and Noam Chomsky, who's has been sort of close to Ganji. While he was in prison, he wrote something called the Republican Manifesto,
mm-hmm.
Which was an interesting kind of political philosophical statement arguing that Iran, though it has a religious society in which obviously Shiism is the dominant religious outlook, it ought to have a secular state in which there would be no special privilege for Shiism. So it was a break not only from the government but from the regime, a break from the idea of an Islamic republic.
Right.
I think, and part of his argument was that contrary to the view that religion flourishes in a religious state, his argument was that religious piety would better flourish in a secular state in which religion and politics were not so closely intermingled. I think since being released from prison, since coming to the United States, he's become more of a skeptic about, he's written some skeptical stuff about at least fundamentalist fascism itself. But in this is a remarkable, you know, brilliant, courageous person. I think it was wonderful that Cato chose him for the Milton Friedman Award, and I think particularly important from my point of view, because this was really not a, how to describe it, it was not a kind of narrowly ideological choice. I mean,
right.
Ganji, is, as his speech indicated, is in many ways a kind of political, progressive, sort of a guy of the left. But he's, you know, like I think lots of other people on the left, a strong believer in liberty and democracy.
Yeah, basic, so basic liberal values, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So so you were at the occasion?
I was, and I was very proud of Cato that night, and particular proud of how it it just blows people's minds who are trapped in the usual left-right way of thinking, because the at the dinner that night, the keynote speaker was George Will, who didn't talk anything about Iran and basically served up a lot of intelligently done, small government-oriented, right-wing red meat for the crowd. And then along came Akbar Ganji, who, through his interpreter, offered up a very different sensibility, where where the thrust of his talk was talking about U.S. culpability in supporting dictatorial regimes over the years in the Middle East, and how that has contributed to the rise of fundamentalism that he has been waging his own valiant struggle against. There just isn't another place in town, I don't think, that that would have had those two guys up on the same podium on the same night. So it was a treat. I would say that, and we'll provide a link to his Cato, to his Friedman Prize address, because you published it on your Boston Review site, as I recall.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
The text of it, translated, of course, text of it on the
right.
Boston Review site. Yeah.
So I would take some issue with his remarks. Absolutely, I believe that that the U.S. Cold War practice of favoring sons of bitches as long as they were our sons of bitches has had nasty blowback in more recent years. But I think Ganji doesn't, he goes too far in blaming us for all the region's troubles. He basically argues that because the United States and other Western governments propped up dictatorial governments, there was no outlet for dissent other than religious fundamentalism. The fact is, though, that we propped up dictatorial regimes in Latin America and East Asia, too, and that didn't give rise to religious fundamentalism. So there was something unique to the culture of the greater Middle East that has spawned this problem, and you didn't get that from his remarks, but nonetheless, he was talking to an American audience about what Americans' responsibility and role is in this mess, and I think on the whole, his comments were well aimed.
Yeah, I thought I kind of agree, particularly with the qualification that you just added about who he thought he was addressing in the audience. I mean, there were moments in the speech where he said, you know, the kind of requisite things about how he wasn't just, you know, blaming the West or blaming
right.
the United States, but that he did, for this audience, emphasize something that people probably haven't been hearing very much lately, which was that this, you know, absence of other outlets than religious fundamentalism as a vehicle for expressing, you know, national aspirations. There also was...
And just aspirations for a better life that had been squelched by, right. You know, political repression and economic stagnation.
That's right. And there also was, coming closer to the present, so there was a story about how the rise of religious fundamentalism was in part, maybe in large part, a consequence of the support for dictatorial regimes by the United States and the British, among others, but also coming closer to the present, that the situation in Palestine has only served to make the politics of the region worse. That's also been true of the decision to shift from support for dictatorial regimes to the use of military force, both in Afghanistan and then in Iraq as well. And then I thought probably my guess is for this audience, the most controversial was when he came closer to the present and he said that he thought that the policy of putting pressure on Iran in particular not to go nuclear,
right,
rather than pressing for a general nuclear-free zone
right,
in the region, was perceived, rightly or wrongly, was perceived as a continuing, you know, kind of imbalance in American policy, and also had some things to say on the issue of sanctions, which I found a little bit hard to follow, though, as I understood it, the argument was something like there should be very selective sanctions that would keep the regime from getting instruments of repression, but that broader sanctions, what he, I think, would describe in the translation as careless sanctions,
yes,
would have as their principal effect a strengthening of the regime and damage to the democratic forces.
Yeah, right, and concept. You know, further harming the victims of the regime by adding to their suffering, while creating, as often happens with economic sanctions, a rally around the government kind of nationalist reaction.
Right, and there was a survey that was done. As I mentioned, a survey that was done a few years ago, and I can't remember who exactly did it, but there were that. It was a survey of the extent of nationalism in different countries, nationalist sensibility in different countries around the world. And as I recall, the United States came out first in Iran, and Iran came out second. So
that's interesting.
That's a particular concern there. But I guess I thought that it was particularly important, and not specifically for a Cato audience, but I think for a more general audience, to hear somebody who has, you know, made large sacrifices for the cause of democracy and personal freedom in Iran, and, you know, say that policies that of, you know, generalized sanction and high degrees of pressure against the regime were no good because they were damaging to the cause of Iranian democracy.
Yeah.
This, by the way, was his getting this prize made him a target of criticism both from the regime in Iran and also from the left. So the left said, you know, so there's you know, Milton Friedman, Chicago boys responsible for repression in Chile, you know,
yada, yada,
in the 1970s,
yada, yes.
And there's, and then I think the regime was actually quoting chapter and verse from the criticisms of the Iranian left directed against Ganji. So anyway, very good choice by Cato.
Yeah, and I don't want to get into the whole Chile thing again, but...
But
Friedman was... was tireless in stressing the fundamental unity of economic and political freedom, and that particularly when he was speaking when totalitarian socialism was an alternative model to ours, that the full-scale suppression of markets went hand-in-hand with the full-scale suppression of dissent.
There were two points just to lead to.
And so I thought it was very nice to have a Friedman Prize going to someone who clearly wasn't focusing on economic freedom but was focusing on political and personal freedom.
Yes. There were at the end of the speech he did, it was a very elegant and gracious way of bringing Friedman in, because you know, Ganji is not a Friedmanite. But it was a Friedman Prize, and so he had to find some way of connecting his concerns with Friedman's. And I think there were two ways that he did it. First, he observed that this regime of what he was describing as careless sanctions, the imposition of careless sanctions, would strengthen the ability of the regime to destroy markets.
Yeah.
And that was bad for the progress of democracy. And then he also emphasized at the very, or pointed out at the very end, that Friedman himself was a kind of subtle thinker about markets, and that Friedman had urged the importance of both education and a negative income tax as an anti-poverty policy, because markets don't solve all problems. So even though Friedman thought on the education side that you should have a system of vouchers, which in a certain way produces a kind of educational market, he did think that the voucher should be financed out of taxation,
general
revenues. And so he found the places in Friedman's view that he could most strongly connect with.
And, there's a strange phenomenon that just the byproduct of ideological polarization. Milton Friedman in particular, details here or there I vary on, but the spirit of his ideas about government is very much my own. He's very strong liberal in the classical sense, supporting personal and political freedom and a light touch when it comes to regulating economic affairs, but no absolutist at all. So he supported a minimum income through the negative income tax, and he supported universal public education through a voucher program. And so he, as did Adam Smith before him, saw a role for the state in providing public goods.
Hayek did exactly the same,
more extensively than Friedman.
This
tends to get forgotten by people on the left who like to portray Friedman as just a one step away from an anarchist, and it also tends to get forgotten by people on the libertarian side who trumpet Friedman and Hayek as their most famous and influential champions, but often the more radical libertarians, at least, ignore the fact that they saw that that there was a positive role for government in these areas.
Yeah, those are the libertarians who refer to Cato Institute as Stato Institute.
That's right. So let's switch gears now and talk about we'll talk about the oil spill, but more specifically, we'll talk about Obama's political problems as a result of the oil spill and the growing chorus of blame and frustration that somehow or another he hasn't deployed his magical superpowers to make this thing go away.
Well, he certainly that's certainly true that he hasn't done that.
To me, the best angle to view his current torments is my friend and colleague Gene Healy's book on the cult of the presidency, which he wrote a couple of years ago back when Bush was president, talking about the trend over the 20th century towards the imperial presidency mm-hmm. in expanding the powers of the executive branch. But beyond that, the great shift in political culture in terms of expectations about what yes. the presidency means and what a president is supposed to do,
yeah.
To the point where we now have some confluence of the rise of big government and the rise of celebrity culture has created has made the inhabitant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue into this kind of surrogate king / demigod / superhero who is supposed to feel our pain and emote yeah. properly at moments of national grief and suffering, and is just assumed to be omnicompetent and gets all kinds of undeserved credit when things are going well and all kinds of undeserved blame when things are going poorly. Case in point, Obama now.
Yeah, there's some old studies about how presidential popularity, goes down when there are shark attacks. I think, there was we're going to come to Rand Paul in a second on civil rights, but right. there was also the Rand Paul remark in connection with British Petroleum and the oil mess about how we've got this blame culture where accidents happen and people go around blaming and they shouldn't do that, and of course what he meant was not that people shouldn't be blaming Obama for it. He meant that it was wrong for the Ken Salazar to be talking about putting the heel of the boot on the neck of British Petroleum. He was
right.
selectively protecting British Petroleum from being blamed. I mean, I am not looking for Obama to be emoting. I do think that some finger pointing is appropriate here. British Petroleum does not have a great record of
I don't know a lot about this, but I've read that the kinds of safety and health violations they've racked up are just huge in comparison to some of their
right.
competitors.
These are OSHA violations. So
right.
at the top of the list of OSHA violations are what are called flagrant violations. And they've got 90 in their business, in the energy business, they've got 97% of the flagrant OSHA violations.
There are plenty of
kind of lesser degrees of violation around, but workers are kind of the canary in the coal mine. And if you're treating your own, people who work for you pretty badly, it's a sign that you're probably not generally a very good citizen. And, they got a big fine for the 2005 refinery explosion in Texas. And mm-hmm. But, these are, I guess for them, these are costs. They regard these all as costs of doing business. So I think that there has been some... I think some failure on Obama's part to do, exactly what Rand Paul was, I think, absurdly criticizing him for doing, namely putting some considerable part of the blame for this on British Petroleum. I say Rand Paul was absurd about it because he said in particular that it was un-American.
Right.
Blame. This is just ridiculous.
Right.
It's a preposterous statement. He doesn't like it, but the idea that it's un-American to think that businesses sometimes do really bad things and should be blamed for doing those things, I think is just absurd.
Right. Because, businesses are run by human beings, and human beings are we're all heirs to Adam, living in this fallen world, sinful creatures.
So that's a point on that I think that's exactly right. I think it is something, though, that I think Obama can also fairly be criticized for overlooking. I mean, he's a brilliant guy, has a real mastery of lots of policy stuff, knows how to talk about it at a very high and sophisticated level, and surrounds himself with other people who can. But I think he sometimes what can I say, overlooks the fact that people in these discussions about what to do about something like this bring interests to the table and not just ideas. And, you know, he says, you know, he said about British Petroleum, you know, you're not going to get anywhere by yelling at people. Well, I don't know. I'm not sure that that's right. It's certainly not generally true that you're going to get someplace by having a calm and discussion with a bunch of, you know, sophisticated talkers sitting around the table and neglecting the fact that there are some people in the room who would really have very powerful interests in downplaying their responsibility for the spill, yes, the size of the spill, the costs of the cleanup, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, but the fact is, right now, no one has a sharper incentive to stop this gusher than BP, and because you know they're on the hook for paying for all this, and no one has greater expertise about dealing with deep sea oil wells than BP and other petroleum companies. Certainly, the government doesn't have any kind of comparable expertise. So the idea that is, I mean, the reason there's frustration, I think, is just because this thing just keeps leaking away and nobody knows what to do about it, and there's frustration. And then there's this just sense that, well, Obama, you're in charge, so why aren't you doing something? And I get the, I think about the goofy movie from the 90s, Independence Day, where President Bill Pullman, ex-fighter pilot, scrambles a jet and goes up there and blasts one of the big spacecraft out of the sky with a nuclear missile. And I picture, you know, Obama commandeering a sub and doing likewise with the
Getting a big straw and sucking up all the oil out of the ocean.
So
we have these
preposterous ideas for what they're about what they're capable of doing. And then I've also been thinking, well, What would Clinton be doing under these circumstances? And you know, he just has that touch that he would have figured out the right photo op to be in, with his lips trembling and a tear dripping down his face, and he would have done it right. And Vulcan Barack Obama just doesn't have that sense of how to emote properly in these circumstances when you really can't do anything except emote. So he's caught up short here, but here's the
difference. And to give, I agree, Clinton has all of those qualities and Obama doesn't have them, and I think doesn't have them in ways that people find somewhat surprising, that they thought he did, because he's capable of this kind of uplifting rhetoric. But there's something else that I think Clinton might have done, and I take the case of FEMA as an example.
Yes,
the emergency the federal emergency management agency. I mean, one of the things that Clinton did in his administration was he really rebuilt FEMA.
Yes.
It was then subsequently cut off at the knees in the Bush administration, which was not a very good thing for what happened with Katrina. And
no, I think didn't Brownie do a heck of a job?
He did do a really good job. Yeah, he did a bang-up job, Brownie. Right. You know, but that, I think, the issue is about blaming Obama to the extent there is blame to be, you know, put on his shoulders or the shoulders of the current administration, is not about what they were doing, you know, the day after. But you know, it was pretty well known that... you know, drilling really deep is pretty dangerous. They're really dangerous. There are worst case scenarios that had come out of the Mining Management Service, and there were no remedies for what they had identified as the worst case scenarios. These blowout preventers were leaking fluids before the explosion took place. And there was nobody running the show. So I think that the place to look, if you're thinking about where there was a failure, was not on what happened the day after or the week after, or they didn't build enough berms or whatever.
Right.
How many berms are good to build? I have no idea. But there was a regulatory failure.
Absolutely.
And how exactly, how to trace out that regulatory failure. To what extent was it, you know, as Arianna Huffington was saying, you know, huffing and puffing about over the weekend, to what extent was this, you know, the kind of, you know, was this failure a result of the what the Bush-Cheney people would regard it as a success? To what extent was it something that could have been remedied in the year prior? You know, that's, I think there's an argument to be made there, but I think I agree with you that the place to look in focusing, in attributing responsibility or in figuring out what should be done is not in the days since the explosion took place. But I think there is an interesting and important lesson to be learned about why you need, you know, these very mundane, unfancy, but hugely important regulatory bodies in place to deal to address these.
Yeah, and post hoc, we'll go back and we'll see what MMS should have done to, or someone else should have done to have seen this coming. But the fact is that human beings just aren't very good at dealing with low probability, high impact risks. You go a long time between, you know, there's this small chance of something terrible happening, and it's been a long time since anything like that has happened, and you just inevitably, both the regulated industry and the regulators themselves get to thinking they're on top of this, and there really isn't anything to be concerned about. And we saw that in the financial crisis with the black swan of a nationwide decline in house prices catching everyone unawares, and we've seen it here.
I agree with you in general terms about that, Brink, but I think in this case, as I think is often the case when one of these disasters happens, is that it wasn't that people were sitting around thinking, gee, oh, you know, something terrible might happen. Who knows exactly what it might be? It's a low probability event that hasn't happened yet. Let's move on. That what you had was people who were worrying about exactly what happened. I mean, people worrying about failures in blowout preventers for 15 years, and people worrying about these blowout preventers leaking fluids and
I'm saying they've been worrying for 15 years, and there wasn't a catastrophe, and so that enables folks who have financial incentive not to worry or to dismiss the worries to have grounds for saying you're crying wolf. So
now we get to I think the issue, which is that it's exactly at that point that you don't want to happen what has in fact been the case with MMS, which is, as you know, Salazar has said, it's basically been a pal of the
we had a regulatory agency. It wasn't unregulated, but as often happens, as Chicago school economists point out, regulators often get captured by the industries they're regulating. That seems to be what happened here. I see both private sector malfeasance and the limitations of big government in dealing with them. I see a kind of problem with the human condition here rather than sort of ideological point scoring.
No, this isn't about ideological point scoring, but it does go back to the issue about the contrast between Obama and Clinton, and that's why I gave the example. Clinton did have. I'm not Clinton's biggest fan, but I think Clinton did have a success in that case, which, you know, that was something, you know, you were saying, what would Clinton have done? He would have
promoted, and his
lips would have shaken. Well, he also might have done something about MMS in a way that I think, you know, in a way that Obama didn't do. It's very easy.
As I recall, back in 92, there was a big Hurricane Andrew that walloped Florida a very slow response in dealing with it, and Bush kind of took it on the chin for relative inaction. And so I think, you know, Clinton applied lessons from that experience definitely bolstered FEMA.
I guess what I'm saying, so that we can move on to that, this was not just kind of abstractly a concern. This was a pretty granularly understood disaster waiting to happen. Now, of course, it's always true that it, you know, with 2020 hindsight, there's always you know, somebody who was pointing to this as a disaster waiting to happen and 2 billion other disasters waiting to happen. And there's a lot of noise and it's hard to pick out the signal. But this, anyway, you...
But right now we're treated to the spectacle of conservatives bashing Obama for not... I don't know, you know, being more
doing
activist,
not doing something.
And that's kind of funny. In the same way,
it is a little bit, I mean, right,
in the same way that people were bashing Bush. I think we can bash Bush appropriately for having put a stooge at the head of FEMA. There was concentric circles of responsibility for the Katrina disaster, and I wouldn't put the federal government's responsibility as sort of central to the mess, but they were a player. But you know, Bush got the lion's share of the blame and political, and got a lot of political costs from that, incurred a lot of political costs from that, and maybe more than was the federal government's share, Now you have people on the left defending Obama, judiciously saying there's only so much a president can do in the aftermath, and you have conservatives who were defending Bush at the time now attacking Obama for not doing more. So it's your usual dance of the partisans.
Well, Rush Limbaugh turned on a dime on this, from saying it wasn't a big deal to saying this was Obama's disaster. And it's an ugly spectacle, and I agree with you. There were plenty of comparably ugly spectacles under Bush. I think we could break through the ugly spectacle and ask in a more discerning way what might have been done. And I do think that there were things ex ante that Obama and the administration could have done and said they wanted to do but didn't get to do. And then there's an issue about why they didn't do them. We can speculate about their will, about industry capture, about, you know, obstructionism in Congress, about getting anything done. But let's move on to another topic.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Rand Paul before, and this is a little old now, but he kicked up a big flap a few weeks back when he expressed skepticism about the public accommodations provisions of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and then found he had wandered into a PR buzzsaw and backtracked a bit, and ultimately said he would have supported the act. That then raised the issue of the libertarian position on civil rights, on the Civil Rights Act, on civil rights more generally, and occasioned a lot of interesting writing from my part of the ideological world on this subject.
Including writing by you.
I gave a quote to a reporter. Paul, just for clarity's sake, does not use the word libertarian to describe himself. In fact, he denies he is libertarian. Though his dad ran on the libertarian platform, and back in '88, he was the Libertarian Party presidential candidate before his run as a Republican last go round. Anyway, but Rand Paul is definitely a small government conservative, although he has departed from libertarian purity on a number of issues, such as the drug war and the war on terror. But here he was following in the tradition of Barry Goldwater in defending racists' rights to freedom of association. That is an essential bedrock core principle of freedom is that you ought to be able to consort with whom you want and stay away from whom you want, and that's going to mean that repellent people exercise their freedom in repellent ways. So just as we have to hold our nose and allow the Westboro Church nuts to say all kinds of horrible, loathsome, hateful things, we should hold our nose and allow racists to be racists. That's the argument, and it's an argument that that I think is has real weight, but in this particular case, it is weight that is, to my way of thinking, utterly overwhelmed by the weight of broader circumstances. So that as a general matter, I think that, yes, freedom of association is a really, really important value, and it's not just important when we like what people are doing. And that in particular, businesses ought to be able to have a... There's a strong presumption that they can have rules for who comes into their store. And they can even be crazy rules, like the example I used with the reporter was the soup Nazi from Seinfeld. He was kicking people out of his establishment all the time for insane and arbitrary reasons. I don't think that should be against the law. But here we're not talking about idiosyncratic individual behavior. We're talking about... we're talking about the coordinated enforcement of a social norm, a racist norm that was first enforced by state-backed coercion through a whole raft of racist laws mandating segregation in state facilities, and sometimes mandating segregation in private businesses. And then also undergirded by violence at the private level, tolerated by the state, so that when people violated Jim Crow in the South, they often faced gang violence as retribution, and the state turned a blind eye and allowed such violence to occur with impunity. So here you have a system of a broadly shared cultural norm of racism backed by violence at the top and bottom of the social scale, and the state deeply implicated in all of it, and the whole system adds up to a cohesive system of oppression, and that system was an abomination by libertarian standards, and it was a great victory for human freedom when that system was toppled. And I regard the Title II provision of the Civil Rights Act, on which outlawed discrimination in public accommodations, that is, businesses generally open to the public, couldn't discriminate on the basis of race, to be an appropriate means towards the end of toppling this oppressive system.
So I think I agree with what you've said, and I would put.
And I'll just throw in that a number of libertarian colleagues, like my Cato colleague Julian Sanchez, University of Chicago Professor Richard Epstein, George Mason Law Professor David Bernstein, and Georgetown Law Professor Randy Barnett, all wrote things along similar lines, and maybe we'll post those.
Yeah, and very, Richard Epstein said something like, "You'd have to be brain dead not to understand, you know, the rationale for Title II," as he observed, and this was an encapsulation of part of what you said. Lots of businesses were in favor of Title II, because they didn't want to be subject to sanction for departing from the norm of racial segregation. So, if there's a general norm of racial segregation, and you say, "Well, I'm going to, open my accommodation to black as well as white customers," then you're subject to sanction. And I guess the one thing that I would emphasize is that the sanctions that people are concerned about here were not just violent sanctions. You know, you get your store blown up, or there's a system. There were all kinds of informal sanctions imposed on people for departing from the norm, which is why the kind of the argument that the market would have taken care of it doesn't really have that much force, because these were so long as these private sanctions were in place, these informal sanctions were in place, there's no reason to think that the market would have taken care of this racial exclusion once the rest of the Civil Rights Act was in place. But here's a question that I have for you. So you said that for the reasons that you gave, maybe elaborated to include not just violent sanctions, but also a variety of other informal sanctions, you favor Title II of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. But Title II of the Civil Rights Act is not just about race. And the argument that you've given, and this is, I think, true of all the other historically contextual arguments of Barnett and Bernstein and Richard Epstein as well, very powerfully stated and, you know, elegant and forceful. But they all go to the issue of race, whereas Title II extends beyond race. It's about discrimination on the basis of national origin, religion, and so there's a general opposition to excluding people from public accommodations.
Yes.
An anti-discrimination principle. Excluding people from a public accommodations, not confined to race. The argument that you give sounds like you maybe think that that was overreaching. Is that fair?
I think that the case is strongest in race and gets weaker. Where exactly the line is to be drawn, I think, is on public accommodations is. I haven't thought through completely, so I'm not sure what I think about the application of that non-discrimination principle in public accommodations on to other bases besides race. I think businesses discriminating on other bases are acting wrongly. But exactly when discrimination should be okay, whether it's with respect to accommodations or membership in organizations or hiring or whatnot, I think is a complicated question. We think it's okay for historically black colleges to discriminate against to discriminate in favor of African American applicants, I'm sure we think it's okay for religious organizations to discriminate in favor of co-believers in hiring. So I feel like
co-believers in favor of hiring. That's I think if you start with the case of discriminating in favor of, you know, Catholics when you're hiring a priest or Jews when you're hiring a rabbi, that sounds like a bona fide occupational qualification.
Yeah, that's right. Fair enough.
I agree with you that there's a hard issue here. I think one thing that, you know, is one test that you want to think about here is, you know, if I'm the owner of the public accommodation, a.k.a., you know, the restaurant, the inn, the bar, the motel, and I say, I'm not going to serve you. And, you know, I put up the sign, you know, I don't serve whatever, Catholics here or Jews, whatever, or Asians. And I put up the sign, and then you come in and you sit down and you're waiting to be served. There's going to come some point where I'm the owner of the thing. I'm going to call the police.
Yes. You know, that's
AKA
right.
The state.
Yes. And bring them in to enforce my noxious views. Right.
Right. And now the state is going to be implicated in enforcing discriminatory taste.
And that's very problematic. So I guess what I would, if there's a general principle, I would distinguish between idiosyncratic discrimination and systemic discrimination. That if there is a kind of a general norm in society that is discriminatory and is being enforced collectively by people in a way that is subjecting particular groups to second-class citizenship, then I think it is. There may very well be a need for government to step in and address that oppressive social norm to reverse it through anti-discrimination legislation. Where where the discrimination is idiosyncratic and individualistic, I don't think there's really any need for a government law. The government law is not going to do any harm, but it's just not a problem, right? So basically, Title II has been a very sleepy area of the law for a long time because people just accepted it immediately, and by and large, it's been self-enforcing. So I rather doubt that if Title II were eliminated today, you might see local businesses in particular places reverting to racist patterns of behavior, but discrimination on the basis of religion or no Irish allowed or stuff like that, I just don't think that's going to happen anymore. So
well, I think you're forgetting about our fallen nature. Assume the worst.
No, right, but you know, culture really has changed, and if there were a business that were behaving in some way that the overwhelming majority of people thought was disgusting, that business is going to pay a price now. All right, maybe market forces couldn't have overcome a racist norm, but they can enforce an anti-racist norm that's already in place. So basically, that's where I come down is that what matters are the rules that society is organized by, and those rules can be government enforced or they can be enforced culturally. And if the rules are illiberal and oppressive, then there may be a role for government to try to change the culture.
So what I'd say, and that we have to wrap this here, so this is not going to be, this is just going to be an effort to, you know, summarize what the issue is, and then mm-hmm. pursue it further another time. So I think we agree that there was something misguided. I know we agree that there was something very misguided about what Rand Paul said. It has nothing to do with his being a racist or not being a racist. It has to do with his attitude toward this provision of the Civil Rights Act, public accommodations mm-hmm. provision. So one response to it is that his hesitations on this reflected an insensitivity on the specifics of the race issue and the ways in which racial inequality and racial subordination had become socially embedded so that you couldn't pull the plug on racial subordination just by getting the government out of the business of racial subordination. You needed to have the public accommodations provision. So it's something specific about race that he was overlooking. There's one extension beyond that which you're suggesting, which is that what race, it's not just about race, it's about systemic exclusion, systemic subordination.
Yes.
There's a third position, which is that you don't want the government to be in the position of enforcing attitudes that say that some people are less worthy than other people. Whether it's race, whether it's race or not, and whether it's, you know, a systemic case of systemic social subordination or not. And government is always going to be in the business when it comes to property rights.
Hauling away
trespassers, enforcing
those
because you call the police. So do you want the government to be in the business of enforcing attitudes to the effect that some group is less worthy than another group, which extends the anti-discrimination concern beyond the issues of systemic subordination and certainly beyond the issues of race. But I think that's a topic for...
No, I agree with you. I think the point that the state is implicated by being brought in to haul away trespassers is an important one and distinguishes the whole public accommodations realm from purely private behavior.
Yeah. Good place to end. Good to talk, Brink.
All right. Nice talking, Josh. Look forward to doing it again soon. All right.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.